It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 228, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, WordStar still exists, Google Pixel, AI movies, a little mini.
Good afternoon, Gary. How's life in Denver these days?
Oh, very good. How's the Pacific Northwest?
Gray.
Yeah.
The operative color of this week is gray, which honestly, I'm quite happy with. It's like 70, 75. And the reason I'm quite happy with that is that this Saturday is the 20th annual Corgi Picnic in
Yay.
Our yard. So yeah. we'll have 100 corgis running around the backyard and causing all sorts of mayhem. We've had it on rainy weekends, which is, you know, doable. You just end up with a lot of wet dogs. The ones that are the most painful are the ones where we're like really sweltering in the heat. I think we did end up actually canceling one because of heat one time. But looking forward to that. And I forgot to mention last week that last Saturday, the 10th, was the 21st anniversary of Ask Leo.
Oh, wow. Okay.
My first answer was published on August the 10th, 2003. It was, how do I hide the status bar in Internet Explorer 6, which gives you a sense for how old it was.
Yeah.
long time ago. Life was different back then. Mm-hmm. Speaking of life being different back then, to go even further back, the first thing I ran across this week, did you ever use WordStar?
No. Okay. There was an Apple II version of that, wasn't there?
There might have been. Yeah.
I mean, I used Apple Writer or Mac Write, and they were, you know, those days, but yeah.
So I cut my teeth on CPM, and CPM, I think, had its own text editor of some sort, mm-hmm. as most OSs do. But then WordStar came along, and it revolutionized how I did things. It quickly became not just my quote-unquote word processor, but it was my code editor. I mean, I was using it for everything. It was really, really useful. Something really new, something groundbreaking back in those days. And we're talking, you know, like the early 1980s. I mean, I was using it in like 81, 82. And, what cracks me up is that I believe some of the keystrokes we take for granted today to maneuver within some text editors actually had their origins in WordStar, which is always, interesting to, WordStar is gone, sort of the company's long gone, but it leaves its mark in other ways. Anyway, as it turns out, you can get it again. You can run WordStar if you want to on almost any platform. There's an article I will point to in the show notes from OCDNet that basically points to somebody who very carefully and meticulously resurrected WordStar and has it running in one of on MS-DOS, but then recommends various DOS emulators these days. So basically you take a DOS emulator and run that under Windows or Mac or even Linux, and then all of a sudden you can be running WordStar if you want to. I just for some reason, it just tickles me that thing is still leaving a mark after all these years, especially after how enamored I was with it. There are, of course, stories of particular authors still using WordStar to this day intentionally. Mm. I believe George R.R. Martin is one of them, who, they just stick to it because in part, I'm sure it's because it's what they know, but also, it does what they want and they just don't need to change. So anyway, I just thought that would be interesting for those of us of an age that might be interested in revisiting the past. WordStar is available.
Cool. Yeah. It seems like when software is well done, even when after it ages and is left behind by new technology, if it was well done originally, people just still have this fondness for it.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Certainly true for a lot of games too.
Yes. Yep. Very true. I haven't played, Duke Nukem. Those are the ones that first started showing up on some of these emulators. And again, that was just a good game in its time and it lives on. Yeah. So, The thing I was going to bring up this week, yesterday, I think it was, Google announced the new version of their Pixel phone. Now, full disclosure, I run a Google Pixel 6 Pro, have had for several years. I'm actually very happy with the phone. I will not be upgrading to the 9 because I have no need to at this point.
Okay.
But if my phone were to die, I would certainly, you know, just head on over to the 9, which was the new one. The 9 Pro would probably do it for me. A couple of interesting changes in the phone, though, or additions, features, whatever you want to call it, the stuff that they're highlighting. One is that there's the traditional, here's a Pixel 9, here's a Pixel 9 Pro. Oh, and here's the Pixel 9 Fold. Everybody seems to be getting into the folding phone concept. Now, I don't think, do you know if Apple has it even on their radar, rumor-wise?
Oh, yeah, no, there are rumors that they are still working on it and that they, you know, think 2026, maybe 2027, that they're thinking of a folding iPhone model.
I have mixed feelings on the concept. I want to see it proven first before I, and it's like, you know, very expensive. I mean, the Pixel 9 Pro starts at, you know, just under $1,000. The Fold starts at just under $1,800. So that's quite a jump for a, you know, yes, it's effectively a larger screen, but that's really all you're buying. Anyway, I just thought it interesting that they went down that path. It'll be interesting to see how it does, especially in comparison with some of the folding alternatives out there. Of course, they're baking in AI. You can't release a product these days without AI being mentioned. So Gemini will be on the phone. Exactly how the load gets shifted between the phone and online services is unclear. But you know, they're claiming it'll, you know, Gemini will be wonderful and be able to do all sorts of things for you. You know, not just voice response, but also I think baked into the photo editing app and some of the other things that that you know, we're seeing AI used for these days. Yeah, of course, they have taken steps to improve the camera a little bit more. The thing that caught my eye, I mean, yes, it's, you know, this many megapixels, yada, yada, all that good stuff. But they're claiming 8K video, which I find interesting. I have mixed feelings on 8K video because when it comes to watching something, even on a big screen, 4K seems plenty. So I'm not really sure what 8K gets you other than what I end up doing with my still shots. You know, when you've got something with just lots and lots of pixels, you have more opportunity to crop and, you know, compose your photo a little bit better. So, you know, perhaps an 8K video will allow you to be a little bit more creative in terms of cropping and just sort of positioning things. They are adding the SOS feature. So if you are out in the middle of nowhere, apparently it will, you know, do the satellite thing to get you help. What I find, what I didn't find, and it may be out there, but I didn't run into it, is exactly which systems they're using, whether there will be a cost, and so forth. But I just like the concept of it being there. What I really want is what most inReach devices have these days, which is what I refer to as slow text messaging. If as long, you know, SOS is fine. That's basically sending out a single message with your location. But if you could then have, you know, some kind of a texting conversation in something, you know, it can be slow, but, you know, anything better than a day, you know, anything better than say 30 minutes or so is an improvement over current inReach. That can actually help first responders, search and rescue, basically be way more prepared for the situation on the ground. Anyway, so that's built into the phone. They, of course, have new earbuds and a watch for this thing. You know, the Pixel earbuds 2, I think it is, and watch 3. I think I've got those numbers correct. So those, of course, are out there. I was looking at all this, and you know, it looks like a nice phone. Like I said, if my 6 were to die tomorrow, I would happily get myself a 9 Pro. However, I have heard, and we may even have talked about it on this podcast, that while Pixels are good phones, Google's flagship phone, They are not a huge seller. And in fact, if you take a look at the market is dominated by Apple and Samsung. That always makes me just a little uncomfortable when buying a phone, especially from a company like Google, who has been known to just say, yeah, no, we lost interest in that product. We're, you know, it's going away. I don't know what their overall strategy is with respect to the phone business. I don't know if it's making them enough money to make it worthwhile. I don't know if it needs to, right? It could be their Android proving ground. It could be any number of different things. But the only thing really that concerns me about the Pixel phones right now is not at all the quality of the phone, just the fact that it's not selling as much as I would hope it was or would. And that, you know, Google has been known to be fickle.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember now. They had a line of phones really early on that they used mostly for testing, for Android testing and stuff. And those had horrible lifespans. I mean, to be fair, they didn't really make those like for sale for everybody. You couldn't go into stores and very easily buy one. But they were for like app developers. And they were using the early, very earliest versions of Android. But at some point I was sent one by Google for like, hey, make your games for Android. What's it called? The Nexus or something like that?
Could be, yeah.
Yeah. And I was sent it. And yeah, I did actually use it to like, okay, let's compile some of my games for this and see if I can get them in the store. And I put it in a drawer, didn't have a plan with it, but I brought it out like a year later, like literally just 1 year, 12 months later, and decided to do something on it. And I went to update it, and I couldn't update it to the current version of Android. It had already like fallen behind, like they just didn't care about it. They like, no, the current version of Android is like 2 or 3 or whatever. It doesn't even work on this phone that we just came out with a year ago. Because, you know, they only sold probably, I don't know, thousands of copies of it. And actually, probably a lot were given away to developers. It was kind of weird. But yeah, that kind of was a shame. It was like, I never got to use it beyond testing a couple of games.
I'll say that with the 6, I have been pleasantly surprised that I've had it, I think, for like 3 or 4 years now. It still continues to get updates. I think it's the oldest version. They don't do the 5 anymore, but it's the oldest Pixel that still continues to get current updates for, you know, things like Android and the applications and such. At some point, I expect that to fall off the table. But like I said, it's already longer than I've expected. So that part at least has been good and bodes well for the longevity of the Pixels in the future.
Yep.
Cool. Anyway, so, you know, that's the one thing that I stumbled across that, like I said, it has direct impact for me. And if I'm suddenly using a Pixel 9 someday, then you'll know that it's because my Pixel 6 went to mobile phone heaven.
Yep. Yep. Well, you know, it's like I upgrade every other year, right. Which, you know, depending who you ask, seems like incredibly, you know, too many upgrades, and or that I don't upgrade enough considering right. What I do for a living. But it just seems like such a waste to do it every year, you know, small incremental improvements every year. The only problem is every once in a while they do make a big jump in something like the camera or the processor right. or something like right. that. And if that's in the off year for me, it's kind of painful. I ran into that with the notch. You know, they had the notch and then they have the little island now where the camera is. And that happened in an off year for me. So I had to wait a whole year really to do videos and experience the dynamic island feature at the top of the iPhone.
Right.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. I've, as you could tell, I've been doing the replace it when I need to, as opposed to replacing mm-hmm. it on any kind of a schedule. You know, the 6 came about because the 4 died. Right. I think the 4 came about because I lost the previous whatever I had. So it's one of those things where I do it based on need rather than schedule. And in the past, the phones have lasted short enough that I was usually close to like a version or two behind the leading edge. But now, you know, 6 is feeling like an old phone, even though it continues to work really well.
Oh, sure.
Heck, the battery life is still better than a day for me, which just amazes me to this day.
Yeah, oh, that's pretty good. The battery's holding out those that many years. I've had, like, I had to get rid of my oldest AirPods. The main problem with them was the battery life because they were getting really old, and those tiny batteries held out as long as they could. But my current Apple Watch is actually pretty old at this point, and that's got a tiny battery in it too. And I'd say it still does pretty well. I mean, since I charge it up every night, it's a non-issue. It's just, you know, I have plenty of battery to get through the day. And then
as long as it lasts a day, that's all that really matters.
Yeah.
I have had situations with the Pixel where, oh gosh, I mean, normally I'd take it up and do the normal thing where you plug it in and charge overnight. But one day, a couple of days, I've forgotten the phone. I left it downstairs. So, and I didn't bother to go get it. And the bottom line was then that, you know, the next day, yeah, I woke up and the phone was at 50%, but that's okay. It would still last the majority of the day anyway. So I was pretty pleased.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
So we talked about AI. We have to talk some more about AI.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really in the news or anything, but it's just been this ongoing thing that if you're not in the industry, which I almost am not, you really miss what's going on in like these various different sectors. And one is, you know, in film, in filmmaking, AI is really just, there's all these tools and there are new developments almost weekly at this point. And they're all over the place in terms of like what the AI tools do. Like a lot of them are, you know, video editors almost, where you're still doing the footage, but you're using AI tools to help you edit. But others are AI tools that are actually generating video, generating scenes for you, like completely on the fly. So the ability to create a scene by just typing a text prompt and describing the scene and then having it generate video, and then just doing that over and over again until you have a film is basically the goal. And there are all these competing tools. And they're all web-based, strangely enough. I mean, I guess it's hard to do it as an app because they change so quickly. You really just have to have everything going on the server and be able to update it.
I'm sure the computing power needed is not something that's probably going to be useful on a PC or on a desktop.
Yeah, and I played with some of these. Like right now, I think it's like almost every week it seems to be a new tool that's like the top dog. And like right now, there's a lot of talk about Runway ML, which I haven't played with yet, but I did play with one called LTX Studio. And it's interesting, you know, what it gets right, really, really right, and what it still falls short with. Like, so with LTX Studio, you could start off simply by just giving a few sentences for the entire thing. So you can say, I want a short film about, you know, this. And I just made up a story about like, oh, a dog wandering into a space capsule, accidentally getting locked in, and then the rocket accidentally lifts off into space. And then the mission control has to talk to the dog and convince it to flip a few switches to allow the capsule to re-enter and come back to Earth. And the dog then becomes this sensation, this like internet sensation for having this adventure. And it was interesting because just by typing a prompt like that, really wasn't any more than that, it generated a whole movie. And it did it by generating a ton of different scenes. It was like 20 or 30 scenes. And each scene was a different step. So it extrapolated on what I said and actually said, here's what happens in this scene, here's what happens in that scene. So it took my five sentences and turned it into like, I don't know, 50 sentences, you know, a few paragraphs of actual text, which was all very spot on to like the feeling of what I wanted, right? It didn't go off and add completely new story elements that had nothing to do with what I said. It just extrapolated on that. Like if you were to pitch somebody on this, like a screenwriter on it, and the screenwriter were to run off and come back and then say, yeah, this is exactly what I wanted, you know? It did a good job with that. It broke it out to scenes really well, which at first I didn't even think about. But then later on, I was like, that's actually really interesting that it broke up everything into all these individual scenes. It was smart enough to know how to put a film together that told this story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably shouldn't overlook that. It seemed easy, but I don't think it is. And then it generates for you on the fly still images from each of these scenes. So at the beginning, you don't have any video, you just have still images. And before that, it actually comes up with the actors. So it came up with the dog. It came up with, you know, so-and-so at mission control, another person at mission control, you know, and it gives them names and it shows you a picture and everything. And you could go in and say, oh, you know, make this an older person, you know, change the color of this person's hair, you know, change the breed of the dog, that kind of thing. And it will, you know, you can keep updating it. But then, you know, you approve the actors and then it goes in and makes these scenes and it just gives you the still images. So you can again, go in and say, oh, no, mission control should be much bigger or much smaller, or, you know, there shouldn't be so many people there. Or there should be more people. You know, you can adjust things just based on these images are generated, which is smart because it's not using tons of power to like create a 5-minute short film that you're going to look at and say, no, 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 everything needs to change. And then each scene is generated on its own. So you say, yeah, okay, generate this scene. And it's just a few seconds. And like the first one would be dog wandering around near a space capsule, you know, and that's all it is. This dog kind of like takes a couple steps, turns to Ted and like sniffs at the entry to a space capsule. And it's kind of really interesting. And you can look at it and you can go in and see the prompt and then change the prompt. Make, you know, ask for more detail, colors, change the scene, change the motion and all that. Really cool stuff. And then each scene was like that. And you could generate each scene by itself and then have it play for you. Or you could have it generate the whole movie and then put it all together. Some really cool things. And you could also go and say, oh, I want this to be realistic or I want this to be like animation, you know, in different styles of animation. So it's really neat, and they're just improving these types of models, you know, from things like Runway and LTX Studio and stuff all the time. Where it falls down a lot were some obvious, you know, things that are obvious to humans, like the fact that from one scene to the next, the space capsule changed how it looked. Like each one was kind of independent of the other. Right. Like and the space capsule in the first scene was like a Mercury space capsule, like the dog could like squeeze into it.
Right.
Whereas at some point later on, the dog's in the space capsule and it's like the size of a room inside there with the dog wandering around in it. So it's like the consistency. But you know, I mean, AI is just not thinking in terms of those. You could still go in and continue to customize each one and really, you know, try to get each thing better. But it was kind of really interesting. It's like, boy, this is moving fast. I've seen tools like this used for smaller pieces. Specifically, I talk with some documentary filmmakers, and a lot of times when you make documentary films, there's just no footage for whatever you're talking about, especially historical stuff. Mm-hmm. Or when somebody's recounting something that happened, but nobody was like filming that or whatever, you know. And AI could do some interesting things because we already in documentary films see fake stuff. We're used to it, right? When, you know, something is being told like, the Wright brothers are about to take off or whatever in their first flight, there may be a shot of a field, right, with the wind blowing through it. That may look like we think maybe the field that they used was, but it was filmed now in an actual real field.
Right.
And you just know, okay, no, there is an HD color film of the Wright brothers field before they took off. You know, right. It's just a given, and you fill it up. And then, you know, maybe it shows pieces of the Wright brothers plane close up from the Smithsonian, but you know, that wasn't from then, it's from now. So people are always making stuff up. Sometimes you have actors, you know, but not even like actors portraying them, but just with their backs to the camera, sitting in the chair pondering something, or, you know, things being written on a chalkboard or, you know, whatever. There's tons of this B-roll that's created.
Right.
And you can create this stuff in AI. And if you didn't create it in AI, you'd be using fake footage anyway that everybody understands. But right. In AI, you could do it cheaper and sometimes with more interest, like historical figures. Might be, you know, imagine a documentary film on Genghis Khan, and you could actually show like a field and have riders on horseback, you know, going through the field in the distance. That would be interesting. Really hard to shoot. But
yes.
an AI, it can make that, right?
Right.
It can make that for almost nothing. For like a $15 a month subscription, you can make that. But if you wanted to actually have that shot in real life, it would cost lots of money to make that shot used for 4 seconds while somebody is talking about it, you know. And so it's interesting uses there. There's also interesting uses on something else. I was using a tool called Hedra, Hedra.
Mm-hmm.
And the deal with this filmmaking tool, and you're probably going to be able to guess why this is of particular interest to me, is you can take a picture of somebody, or what most people are doing is taking like an AI image generator and creating an AI image of a person. And you take that image, you feed it into Hedra, and then you either provide some spoken audio, or you can type, and they will use one of their 11 labs-like voices to generate the audio. And then the person speaks like their news, you know, a talking head on a news program.
Right. Literally a talking head. Yeah.
Yeah. So you could have, you could take your AI generated character and then have them say something. Or as I quickly went and said, I don't need to make an AI generated character. I could just take me, stick that in there, and then have me say something. And I don't even have to use AI generated voice. I could take my voice and say something. Matter of fact, one of the options is to record right there on the site. So you can't just record voiceover. And there was me talking. I even did it with a picture of me with a green screen behind me. So I had me talking, but I never actually used the camera in the production of it. It was just a still image of me and then my real voice. And then there I am talking. And it's really good. Especially considering no consideration was taken for my mannerisms, which is something I know that they could do at some point. You know, I see what they're going for here. They want to get like an AI talking head.
Right.
But to generate like a person's talking head, like I could see an extra step being, you know, let me submit 10 minutes of me talking. And then it will actually use my mannerisms instead of
right.
this generic, you know, the mannerisms that they may maybe figure out by looking at the image. And then it will even look better. But even without that, it was pretty good. So, yeah, that could be an interesting way. You know, imagine making a video like we do, and it has us in it, but we never actually turned a camera on. It just surmised from our audio that this is what we look like when we're talking.
Right.
It could be interesting, and you could make yourself, you know, I could make myself look younger, for instance, or something like that. So anyway, that's really interesting. And actually, someone told me about a use that's already been done. They saw a video of a CEO of a company. Oh, it was a really big, big company too. And there was a video they made. I don't know. I think it was for investors or for something. It wasn't something widely distributed to the public, where that CEO's talking head was in the corner, going through report after report after report. And they noticed that, hey, you know what? I'm looking closely. That's an AI generated head and probably
right.
an AI generated voice. The CEO's time is way too valuable for them to sit in a sound booth with a camera or,
right.
you know, behind a podium with a camera talking all day to say the reports. They just did it all with AI. And that's interesting because it's not like you're fooling anybody. The CEO undoubtedly gave permission. Yes,
right.
please do this rather than have me do it.
Right.
You know, and these reports are all like, you know, already approved by, you know, all these people. Whatever, have me say it as an AI head and an AI voice. And I thought that's a really interesting use of something that, for all I know, was made at Hedra or a similar tool to it.
Did you watch much of the Olympics?
I watched, bits here and there. I know there was that summary, that daily summary.
With Al
personalized
voice, yes.
Yeah, that was interesting. That was just
was
audio, though, right?
Just audio, but I thought it was interesting. And they were upfront about it, but I just thought it was an interesting use of the technology. It sounded good.
Yeah,
you know?
it's a good use for it. I mean, what's the alternative? Is to have you read it or to have it spoken by a computerized voice?
Right.
I mean, why not have it spoken by a voice like that if it works? You should be able to, you know, in the future, you'll be able to choose the voice
right,
that tells you your little news summary. I mean, we're getting close to that with some of the stuff with Gemini and with, you know, ChatGPT to just ask us to summarize today's news. I mean, even if it's not built in, it's you can find many news summarizers out there and have them summarize the news based on your preferred topics or interests or whatever, and then feed that into, you know, 11 Labs or whatever. And it's like a free trial and everything. So some interesting uses. And the thing I like is spotting some of these uses that are not on the same part of the spectrum as the questionable uses, right? I'm not talking about like fakes.
Right.
I'm talking about even things like going to see a movie and the actor that you know is actually AI generated on the screen. Like they didn't actually act that scene. That still falls into questionable use. Not because the actor didn't give permission, but because like you went to the movies to see that actor, you know, jump out of a plane, and now they're jumping out of a plane, but you're not really looking at the actor. But in a case like a news summary or a CEO giving a presentation or a documentary film that has a character, you know, a historical character from 400 years ago, you know, where it would be an actor faking it anyway,
right.
You know, why not? Like, that stuff seems a little cleaner to me as uses for AI. And it's important to remember there are those kind of very clean uses for this technology. It's not all like go straight to the dark place and there's a political ad with a fake person saying a fake message. You know,
right.
That's like
right.
the other end of the spectrum.
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Like I said, I am going to have to go try it and see what I look like, so to speak.
Yeah, it's fun to play with and pretty quick to play with too. The other thing I wanted to talk about is a rumor in the Mac world. So have you ever seen a Mac Mini?
Not recently, no.
Not recently. They haven't changed actually in more than 10 years.
Okay.
They are these, you know, flat square computers.
Right.
That easily sit on your desk. They're not very big. What are they, 8 inches by 8 inches, something like that. And they've been about the same size for a long time now. But the original size enabled them to house a hard disk drive, enabled them to house fans with a full motherboard with
right.
the CPU and all this stuff on it. Matter of fact, they had even optical drives, which almost dictated the size had to be that big.
Sure. Yep.
Now the Mac Minis have none of that, right? First of all, they're using Apple Silicon, so much smaller system on a chip. No fans really necessary. They're using SSDs, of course, so they don't need a big hard drive. There's no optical drive. Even the ports are, you know, USB-C rather than, you know, USB-A. So, you know, the current size of it is like oversized for what they really need. So the rumor is that the next version of the Mac Mini, they're going to remember that it's called the Mac Mini and actually make it smaller. And it's going to be the size of basically an Apple TV, which is just like maybe 3 or 4 inches square. It's small. It's a small thing. I mean, you could literally put a Apple TV in your pocket. I mean,
right.
Not comfortably, but you could. And it's it may be a little taller than the Apple TV, but I mean, be about the same size. I mean, the Apple TV itself has got a processor and SSD and all that stuff in it already. It's really not that fundamentally different. And the interesting thing is that, you know, I saw people debating online. It's like, well, one of the problems is, you know, you charge $600 or $800 for that, and it's so small, you start to have that value thing. It's like, why is this little thing $600? But there are some really interesting advantages that of having a very, very small computer that I think would be fascinating to see it happen and see if these things happen. I mean, the obvious thing is the thing everybody jumps to is using them as servers and render farms, which people already use Mac Minis for. And you can either use them as servers, either web servers or database servers or something like that. And having them small and kind of like on a rack, but you know, you can just put them on a bunch of shelves, is useful. And then having them be a quarter the size means you could pack even more of them in there. And you could also use them video render farms too, is another thing you can do with those. So you have your main computer where you're editing your video, but when it's time to render it, you know, it goes over to the you know, 12 or 24 that you have sitting on a shelf next to you and uses those to render. But there are other things that are really interesting too, because they become really portable, but not in the same way a laptop is portable. You know, a laptop's portable in that anywhere you are, you could take the laptop out and use it. There's the keyboard, there's the screen. You're ready to go. A Mac Mini is missing the keyboard, missing the screen, and missing power, right? There's no battery. You have to plug it into power. So it's not portable in that sense, but it is portable in other senses, like you can move it from place to place very easily. Somebody who uses one at an office and at home can very easily move it between office and home. They could have a separate screen and keyboard at home from the office, but still have the same computer with the same apps and the same data on the drive. And bring it back and forth. That could be something students can do, you know, very easy to have that in your dorm room or apartment. Right. And then when you go home for spring break or winter break or whatever, which could be 2-3 weeks, you could easily take it with you and then use a screen and keyboard, mouse and trackpad there. But also security wise, I think there's an interesting case because I know when my daughter moved into her college dorm years ago, one of the things that was on the list to get was a little lockbox that she could put her laptop in. And you could kind of fix it somewhere. You can lock it to the desk. And then the idea is that she leaves her dorm room, she puts the laptop in the lockbox, locks it, and it's secure. Something which, of course, never happened. But, you know, you hope for the best and you get the lockbox. But having a Mac Mini is an interesting thing because you can, number one, much more easily lock it or hide it away, leaving the screen and the keyboard, which are much less expensive, much less valuable items, out. But you could also take it with you very easily. Right. You know, it's easy just to, okay, this is important to me. There's been some thefts in the dorms or my apartment complex. I'm just going to stick my Mac Mini in my bag, even though I don't have a screen or keyboard to use it with, I just take it with me. And the same thing, even I know there are schools that, you know, lock away their computers at night because security in a public building isn't necessarily as much as they would want. So they have them on little carts, or they have people that come around to the desks and take the computers and put them in the secure closet, lock them. Easier to do when they're tiny. So there are things like that. But the one last thing that I found really interesting of having a Mac Mini is, what if you didn't have a screen for it at all? What if your screen was your Apple Vision Pro?
Right.
Because that screen, you know, and I use it every day like that, that screen is better than any other screen I've got. So do I really even need any other screen? I could just have a keyboard and a Mac Mini and my Apple Vision Pro, which I also use my Apple Vision Pro as an Apple Vision Pro and do things like use the apps inside that. But when I want to use my Mac, it's the Mac Mini I connect to. And so I've got this really small thing now instead of this big thing. Anyway, that could be an interesting use for it. So it'd be interesting to see if Apple goes this way, if they do announce a new Mac Mini later this year or the early next, and they do go down to a totally new size. I think they will. I think I could see people getting really energized about it.
Sure.
And saying, oh, that looks so cool. I can get a new Mac Mini. It's the same price, $600, and I could get it. And it's like that tiny. Yeah, I got to get one. You know, or somebody even thinking, yeah, I've had a MacBook Air, or MacBook Pro for a long time, but I'm thinking I should get a desktop one too. But I don't know. And then they see this new Mac Mini and they're like, yeah, let me max it out for like $1,500 with lots of memory and a bigger drive and, you know, get that model. And it'll be nice and small. And you could even like mount it to the back of a screen.
Right.
Right. It'll be light enough. Or you could mount it just under a desk or in like a desk drawer. It would fit, and just as long as the cables can come through.
So there's a scenario that's been poking around the back of my head as you've been talking, given how small this is. My assumption is, of course, that does the existing Mac Mini, what's its power source? Does it?
It's AC power. Yeah. Wall power. So
it plugs in wall power directly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would be interested in seeing the Mac Mini have USB-C as its power source. Right.
Yeah.
So that it's getting its power over that. Ideally, it would be not the higher voltages. Here's where I'm going. I want it to run off of 12 volts so that I can mount this little box in my car.
Yeah, or a battery.
Or my rescue SUV, right? You know, that I'm using for search and rescue kind of stuff. Because we definitely do pull out laptops, pull out computers to do things. And this would be a very, very interesting use to have that always available.
I love it. I think that would be a really interesting way for them to go. I mean, you could run one. If the Apple Vision Pro's got, you know, it's 2-hour battery life. Future ones may have more. But you can have, if you had a Mac Mini that had USB-C going in and you could get a big battery, it doesn't have to be big, right? Batteries kind of like, they don't have to get too big to have a lot of power. I've got one that actually is, I bought it because it could fill up a tire in a car, you know, slowly, right? But the funny thing about it is it's basically a big battery. It could be used as a battery as well. And oh, no, I'm getting it mixed up. It's not that one. I've got two I bought at the same time. The one that fills up the tires, that just fills up the tires. The one I got with it actually can jumpstart a car.
Ah, yes.
And it's not really that big.
Right.
And yet it is almost all battery, and it has a USB-C output.
Yep. I have one of those as well. And in fact, about a month and a half ago, I ended up using it for the first time. Mm-hmm. I used it on my SUV. I've got a Toyota Sequoia.
Yep.
So it's got a big engine. It had a big battery that was dead. And I was shocked at how well it worked. It just did the job. And there's a little percentage measure on the battery. And after starting the car, it was at like 80, 90% left.
Yeah, no, I got this. I had the same experience
for a while. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I used it to jump. I had our older car, actually the battery was failing. And so we found out and we had to have it jumped. So, you know, you have to wait. Somebody has to come. You jump the car. It was a whole thing.
Right.
But that all that did was get the car home. Now the car had to actually get to the get to where we were getting a new battery,
right?
Which you know was it, which was a few days away. Well, I thought, well, I can either do that or maybe I should get one of these anyway. And if I order now on Amazon, it'll be here tomorrow, and I can use it to jump the car and I could test it out, and I did, and I mean it just worked just immediately.
Yep.
I mean, it just was like, oh, so that whole thing, like my whole, you know, our whole lives of like, you need a whole other car with these big jumper cables to jump a car. And now I've got this thing I can hold in one hand and do it. But anyway, the idea is, you know, it's also emergency power. Like if we did actually have a power outage downtown here that lasted for about 6 hours a while back, which makes you think about larger power outages.
Sure.
And it's like this battery, we could charge both of our iPhones several times over from it. But you could also run probably a Mac Mini that was doing USB-C power very nicely with it, and then have your Apple Vision Pro, which has its battery, and have a keyboard mouse. They both are batteries as well, and run the entire thing while sitting at an internet cafe or an airport lounge or on a plane or, you know, anywhere where you're just not going to have power, maybe.
Right. So there, it's funny. Since, you know, I spend a little bit of time working with emergency management, part of the ham radio thing, part of the animal rescue stuff. And one of the things I bought, gosh, a year or two ago was it's a Jackery is the brand name. And it's basically a little bit bigger than a car battery. But it's and it's full of lithium, you know, lithium ion battery. So it's got a tremendous capacity. It has three 120 volt outlets. It's got a 12 volt outlet. It's got a couple of USB-Cs, a USB-A, all that kind of stuff. And it came with solar panels, so you can trickle charge it, you know, when the weather is good. That thing will, the only thing that really prevents it from jump starting a car is that it's not set up for the high current need a starter has. If you take a look at your little portable for jump starting, it probably has a very heavy duty socket for a heavy duty cable that has the heavy duty clamps that go on the battery, because there's a lot of current that flows through that cable when a car starts. This yeah. doesn't, but it is one of those things where, you know, I could live in the trailer, you know, for multiple days running off of just this battery. It's a wonderful little backup solution. I'll throw a link to that in our show notes just because I think that it's an interesting concept. There's a lot more of them nowadays that are becoming available, but it's an, oh gosh, I bought it in 2021. So I've had it for 3 years. And what I do with it, I keep it in the back of the SUV along with my jump starting battery. And I have it connected in such a way that every time I'm driving, these mm-hmm. things are charging so that they're always pretty much at 100%. So yep. they're always ready to go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So cool stuff. So yeah, that's a good point. It would be extra cool if they had 12 volts like that. We'll see. The Apple TVs don't, so I don't have high hopes.
Right.
But we'll see. So does that make you grumpy?
Yeah, kind of. Mm-hmm. I was reading through my comments on YouTube, which is always an interesting exercise. And somebody started their comment by saying, bruh, B-R-U-H, bruh, and yeah. complained about something. I'm not your bruh. But also, like, it's a filter word. It's another filler word like any, or, you know, ums and ahs. It's like, whatever. Anyway, I answered his question and ended it with bruh. So I doubt that he was of a mind to get the sarcasm in my response. But nonetheless, I left it there for all who follow. Bruh just doesn't do it for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen those too, sometimes spelled differently. But I know it's a popular spoken thing by Gen Z, but I appreciate the Gen Zers that keep it as a spoken piece of speech, because we had, well, you know, all the generations have words
sure.
that are slang words that were used colloquially to address each other. But the one thing that I think is different now because of social media and texting is that these actually make it into written words.
Yes.
Whereas they didn't before. You could use all those words, but then when you would actually write something out or type something out,
right.
those words wouldn't be there. It would be like a different, you know, level of communication. And now texting has kind of blurred the lines.
It has. I was thinking the same thing, that basically texting has become a pseudo replacement for actually talking to people.
Yeah.
But the language that you might use to talk to someone is how they text. And then that spills over into situations like this where you're leaving a comment on a YouTube video.
Yep. The thing that's bothering me is, I guess for lack of a better way of explaining it, is social media clickbait. But it's not quite what you might think. So clickbait typically is stuff produced, you know, by like news sites and stuff, just to try to get a sensationalized headline or a headline that asks a question or only gives you half the story and you want to click on it, right? And there's social media clickbait, normal stuff that's been around for a long time.
Won't believe what happens next.
Yeah, stuff like that. This is a little different. These aren't organizations and these aren't, you know, people just trying to like build up sites and stuff like that. These are actual real people on social media that are finding it frustrating to get people to follow them. And so they find out what you need to do is generate engagement. And the way to do that is to ask a controversial question, or to state a controversial opinion and ask for feedback, or to ask a question that really makes it tempting to answer. Like, it's hard to leave that alone.
Yep.
You know, should I back up my Windows PC? Might be one that would be for you. Like, I can't leave that unanswered, right? Let me go and say you absolutely should. And then you realize that the person asking that knows that you absolutely should. But what they're looking for is they want to get, instead of one response to their post, they want 20 responses or 200 responses. And then that would boost their post and get more people to follow them. And it's, yeah, I'm seeing a lot of it. And I think the reason we're seeing it is because it's like the new generation of post like Twitter type sites, you know, where people fleeing Twitter or X to things like Threads, Mastodon, Blue Sky, and the like. And they end up with, you know, they had thousands of viewers or followers on the Twitter, and now they find that they need to start all over again.
Right.
I'll just do it by posting good content. Oh wait, that's not working. So I have to ask these questions that get people to respond, even though it's not really what I want to post. Anyway, yes. I see a lot of them. I hit reply, I start typing, and then I look and I say, oh no, wait a minute. This person's not, I mean, I get it. They're probably also not happy that they had to post this, but yeah. Anyway,
it's funny because we talk about training the algorithm, right? The algorithm learns from us what we are interested in, but 9 times out of 10, the algorithm ends up training us. This is what you do to make the algorithm happy. And yes, I've been seeing exactly that same kind of content all over the place, often from pages on Facebook that otherwise I actually kind of respect, be it a humor page or an interest, you know, a page of some sort. I get why they're doing it, but you're right, it's frustrating. I fortunately have yet to have gone so far as to actually hit reply. I see it now so much that I know what it is.
Yeah.
So that's not cool. Here's what's cool.
Yeah.
So I've been threatening to for a while. I finally reactivated my Apple Plus subscription so that I could start watching shows on Apple streaming service. And we re-engaged with Foundation Season 2. It's one of the things that I find interesting about Foundation, besides the fact that it's how did I describe the Hobbit movie? It was a familiar set of characters in a very familiar universe telling you a completely different story from the original. So Foundation isn't really, I mean, it has roots in Asimov's books, but it is not, certainly not the same as Asimov's books. And they keep reintroducing characters that you realize, oh yeah, that one, that was from the book and so forth, but the storyline is completely different. Anyway, I'm enjoying it. It's complicated, it's complex, it's thought-provoking, and we're having a good time. I think we're like 3 or 4 episodes into the second season. I know that it's all there. And looking forward to finishing it probably this week. So Foundation Season 1, cool. If you haven't seen it, Season 2 too.
Cool. So I've got one for you. I've got a good one. This is, so on Netflix.
Yes.
I see limited series, one season only.
Right.
And it's called, and the pronunciation I'm not 100% on, Decameron or okay. Decameron.
Right.
Okay. So here's the thing. It's based on a really, really old book or set of stories from the 13th century or something.
Okay.
It was basically these old stories about the Black Death coming to Italy and a group of nobles and their servants escaping to a villa in the countryside to get away from the Black Death. And then what happens when this odd collection of people is at this villa kind of isolated from the rest of society when it looks like the world is ending because, you know, Black Death, they thought, I mean, it was bad, right? Which sounds very much like it could be the premise of like a TV show like The Walking Dead or something like that. I mean, it was very modern premise, but they're real, honest to God, look it up on Wikipedia, old stories from back at that time. And they were apparently written as comedy too. So Netflix made a show about it, but with modern actors. You probably recognize a few of them in there. No, like huge A-list stars, but other ones that appear in lots of different things, like Tony Hale, for instance. And yeah, it's about this group of nobles and servants in this villa, just trying to escape the Black Death. And it's got, you know, there it's in English. they're speaking just, they're also, most of them have British accents for whatever reason.
Of course.
But, you know, it's supposed to be in Italy. Tons of historical humor based on the time, but using modern language. But the cast of characters is really interesting. It really mixes comedy and drama well. I mean, it's mostly comedy, but stuff happens, right? It's not like people don't die in this, right? Stuff really happens in this, but the whole thing is kind of ridiculous in a lot of different ways. A lot of contrast between servants and nobles, and you know, the distinction of, and how that kind of is breaking down in the villa because of, you know, the Black Death and all these other things that are happening. And it's just really good, really well acted, really interesting and funny. Every episode, tons of stuff happens. And it also, I found it interesting is that, you know, I'm somebody that loves the hero's journey, right? You watch something, and I always try to identify who's the hero's journey here. Because if somebody's not having a hero's journey, they're like a side character, even if they're on the screen a lot, right? And it's this one person that's really changing. This one, it's like they're all having a hero's journey, which is fascinating because it means that all the characters are kind of changing during this, which creates some really interesting dynamics and allows things that are happening in later episodes to be completely different than what was happening in earlier episodes. Anyway, just a real delight of a TV show. I mean, it's just got to be this one season. It's just a one time, just a long movie, really. But it's a lot of fun. I think it's 8 episodes, hour episodes. Really good. Definitely highly recommend.
Sounds good. I saw it on the list before we started recording. And in fact, I ran across it I've heard of it a couple times, but I ran across it in more detail this morning and then realized that it was already out because we keep a list of things we're waiting for. So yes, that one is absolutely going on the list. And the fact that you might be recommending it surprises me not at all.
Yeah, cool. All right.
Let's see. So one of the articles that I wrote last week that I'm going to point people at this week is called What is Modern Authentication? It's askleo.com/172824. The issue is that traditional authentication, username and password, is in flux. There are things changing, most notably two-factor authentication, although that even is only one of the steps along the way. What the service providers have done is they've settled on an authentication protocol called OAuth2, so that rather than having your email program ask you for your username and password for your email account, they instead take your username and hand off the whole process of authentication to the actual service that you're trying to connect to. That allows the service to do things like two-factor authentication and more things in the future that the email program is today not ever going to try and handle. That turns out to be a fairly confusing thing, especially when your email program simply asks you, this isn't going to work, or you get a message from Google that says, hey, you need to use modern authentication. What the heck is modern authentication? That's the article. askleo.com/172824.
Cool. I'll point to an article called or video, Extracting Parts of PDFs with Preview. Boy, a lot of macOS has to do with PDFs. I think it's been around for a long time, but I think workflows involving PDFs just get more and more common in all sorts of industries. And there are a lot of things that are built into macOS that handle them directly. So, but I find all the time people are getting third-party software to do things that they already can do with what they have on their Mac. So this is another example of that.
Cool. Yep. One of the things that, of all things, my tax accountant wants me, of course, to send my documents to him in PDF form, but he wants me to remove all of the non-informational pages. So if you've got bank statements, you've got like one page of information followed by 3 pages of disclaimers.
Yeah.
All that kind of crap. So, you know, delete that. And I had that in when I was an Adobe Suite subscriber. That was in Adobe PDF. Mm-hmm. You pick and choose the pages that you want to delete, and you delete them. So, yes, looking for the ability to make changes to PDFs, to edit them in some form is very, very useful.
Cool.
Well, I believe that does us for yet another week.
Yep.
As always, folks, thanks for listening. We appreciate you, and we will see you here again very soon. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/TEH228. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.